I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, January 22nd. We are here on the SFU campus. We got about an interesting show lined up for you today. As you are probably aware by now, there is a transit strike going on in the Vancouver region, and that has affected some of the people who were expected to be up on the show today. Ayu Sakamoto, who was going to bring us a review of an event she went to last week, is not able to come in today. And nor is my regular contributor, Peter. But today we do have Hylene Wang joining us here in the studio. She was part of SFU's official COP28 delegation to the conference last month. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. You were part of... You're part of the official delegation that SFU sent to COP28. Before we get into your experience there, can you tell me a bit about what COP28 was? What is COP28?
Okay, so I think all of these UN terms often are very jargony, and there are so many COPs. So I think COPs arose back in 1992 when they had COP1 in Rio, Brazil. And the probably the most significant COP that everyone knows about is COP21, in which the Paris Agreement was established in Paris. And they kind of rotate between these different regions around the world every year, and they host a COP there. And what they essentially are, they're conferences of parties, and they started out as this like political meeting, almost like a G20 meeting that you hear about, like 200 countries around the world, they gather around, and politicians kind of set the annual goal for the climate every year. But recently, COPs have kind of evolved into this trade show at the same time. So you would get this negotiation on one end, and you can focus on that the whole time there. Or you would get these like different industry professionals who like they're from super diverse industries, but they all have a tie with the climate.
Right.
And then they would show up, and then it would be this big event where you would find out about all these like super cool careers that you wouldn't have known about before you attended.
Right.
So it's like you get the negotiations, and then you get this giant trade show, and you get to choose which one you want to attend.
And this is sort of the biggest forum for the world to be talking about what it's going to do about climate change.
Yeah, so I think it's basically like this annual party about climate change where people go and they geek out about solutions, and then they can also talk about policy. It's basically anything that has to do with climate. You go to this conference.
And some really important stuff does happen here, because as you mentioned, the Paris Climate Agreement, which is sort of perhaps the sort of guiding document for what countries are supposed to be doing these days, came out of one of the COPs, right?
Mm-hmm. And I would say the Paris Agreement, actually, its significance is that you oftentimes hear about the 1.5 degree goal or the 3 degree goal.
Yeah.
And the 1.5 degree goal was explicitly set in Paris, and that was part of the Paris Agreement. And just a little explainer on 1.5, it basically means that we are going, like all countries around the world, they're going to put all of their efforts into limiting our warming to within 1.5 degrees by the year 2100. And that's a very ambitious goal. So before the Paris Agreement was set, actually, the world was on track to heating by 4 degrees by 2100, and that's actually really bad.
Right.
And after the Paris Agreement was set, trajectories were saying that we were heading towards a 3-degree goal, which is also pretty bad. So 1.5 is kind of like the acceptable range where, yeah. I mean, we would still get like a lot of catastrophes around the world. We're still going to get climate refugees, but it's not going to be as catastrophic as 3 degrees.
Right.
So it's a lot of these conferences after COP21 has just been surrounding, like, are we going to actually achieve this 1.5 goal? Or are we actually heading towards our worst case scenario of 3 degrees?
Right. And I guess deciding what are the things that need to be done to make those changes.
Yeah. And to make those changes, I would say, I mean, it involves like all sorts of industries. It's not just climate scientists publishing some papers. Like you have to have corporations participate, and that means setting like net zero business goals for them, and having like divesting away from fossil fuels, right? That's the most important part. And at the same time, because what I just talked about is like the mitigation aspect of it. Yeah. Like we stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere so that we can reach this 1.5 degree goal.
Right.
But at the same time, what if we don't reach the goal? Then we have to adapt to climate change, right? And that means you have to build up like a resilient infrastructure in developing countries, for example. I mean, even in Vancouver, like you have to have like seawalls, you have to insure against like flooding for homes, right? And a lot of that involves a lot of like financing and government funding. And especially when it comes to developing countries, where are they going to get that money from? And that kind of ties into the whole debate about who is really responsible for climate change.
Right.
And oftentimes that's placed on the global north countries, like the US, UK, Canada.
Right. So you're an undergraduate here at SFU still. So how did you get selected to be part of the official SFU delegation?
So for me, I've actually always been really involved in the climate community. I worked for a few years actually in Beijing before I came to SFU, and I worked at Greenpeace in China.
Right.
And I learned a lot about like the multicultural aspects of climate change because when you, like for example, when you hear about Greenpeace or when you hear about like climate activism, you often think of, you know, people throwing paintings, throwing like soup on paintings or like blocking roads. But I think when it's in different countries, for example, like China, where protests are not necessarily institutionalized, like it's not, people are not going to go out and protest when they think about climate change.
Yeah.
So a lot of that, it comes from like a softer perspective where you convince policymakers with other means of campaigning.
Right.
And I learned a lot about climate activism there. And then later on in Vancouver, I was a part of this program with City High Vancouver. It's like a youth civic organization. And I did this youth climate innovation lab program where I investigated into the social cost of carbon. So the social cost of carbon kind of helps us in pricing against carbon emissions in the future. And I think it gave me like a lot of diverse perspectives into how we can tackle climate change in Western countries and how we can tackle climate change in non-Western countries. So I think this kind of helped me in securing a place to go to COP because, again, like the UN is a very multicultural place and you have to be aware of like the cultural sensitivities when you talk about like climate change.
Yeah. So who else was represented on the delegation? You're an undergrad. I presume there were academics and members of the administration.
Yeah. There were there was one person called Sid Mehta, and he is a part of SFU's, like he runs the campus sustainability initiatives. And again, that's more related to like the university and how we can establish a more sustainable campus. And then at the same time, there are also grad student researchers who are studying sustainable energy and like engineering and stuff like that. But then at the same time, we also had like some faculty members with SFU's Beatty School of Business who are studying sustainable supply chains.
Right.
So just from like looking at the delegation in general, I mean, there are so many diverse perspectives when it comes to climate change, right? Like it's not just people who are just studying climate science, but it's people from all sorts of industries and you come together and you foster a solution there.
Great. So what were your goals in attending the conference, both individually but also as a group, as a delegation?
As a delegation, I think our goal was more to connect with members of the Global South, like other youths in the Global South, and to establish this connection between SFU and these and with other countries.
Yeah.
But I think for me individually, I had like two goals.
Yeah.
So currently I study actuarial science at SFU, so that's kind of like the study of insurance. And for me, I really want to investigate more into how we can insure against climate disasters in Canada. And I wanted to learn more about Canada's new national affordable flood insurance program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my goal academically. But at the same time, as a personal goal, because I'm quite engaged in youth climate innovation, so I think I wanted to do more. Again, I wanted to connect with people in the Global South, and at the same time, I wanted to promote the importance of youth participation, because, first of all, youth are the future, and they're vastly underrepresented when it comes to positions of power.
And of course, youth are going to be the people most affected by climate change as time goes on.
Yeah, so, I mean, just for our future, right?
Youth exactly.
should be there. And I also wanted to advocate for more multicultural youth participation. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm a first-generation immigrant and settler in the Vancouver community, so I wanted to see more people who are, international students or newcomers to Canada participate in the climate movement. And I don't want it to just be this, very monocultural place where it's just people who grew up with, cottages out in, rural BC, and they got to experience, what is, the pristineness of the wilderness, whereas with a lot of immigrants, we didn't get that. So, I think having more multicultural youth perspectives when it comes to the climate movement is very important, because these people are going to be affected by climate catastrophes the most.
So we're at the conference, because the conference is huge. It's like thousands of people there.
This year was actually the biggest one in history. So there were in total 80,000 people at the conference.
Astonishing, really, when you think of it.
Yeah, it's like a little city.
So with that many people there, did you find you were able to connect with other youth from around the world, and particularly the Global South, and make connections?
Yeah, actually, I think I made so many new WhatsApp friends. So for me, like I said, again, because I'm a first generation immigrant and settler. So for me, I went to both the Canadian Pavilion events and then also the China Pavilion events.
Yeah.
So just as a reference, every single country, they've got their own little room, which we call a pavilion, and then they can host their own events there. And there are not only country pavilions, but also pavilions with NGOs or other just organizations. You just book a room and then you host your own event like that. So for me, I found that, when I was engaging with Canadian youth or other youth from European countries or even the U.S., they were very, very passionate about anti-fossil fuel rhetoric, which is, of course, is very important at the conference for youth to speak up about that. But what I noticed was that there wasn't a lot of youth from China or even youth from Singapore or Indonesia who were participating in that protests that European and North American youth were participating in. So it was kind of even though it's the UN, there are still two worlds, it seemed There's this Western world where youths are very passionate about anti-fossil fuels. And then at the same time, when you go to the China Pavilion and you talk to youths about their ambitions for climate policy, oftentimes they shy away from protesting. And that's very understandable given the political situation there. But I think there's a huge disconnect between fostering dialogue between youth from the Global South versus youth from the Global North.
So how do you bridge that gap?
Yeah, I think that's a question that a lot of people are trying to answer, because every single year when you read about COPs, you hear about this conflict between the Global South and the Global North, and mm-hmm. it's mainly centering around, for example, like economic development yeah. and then financing. For example, I think this year a big conflict was surrounding, for example, like loss and damage.
Yeah.
So with these islands in the Pacific.
Yeah, and the loss and damage, there was a fund established to help support regions and countries yeah. that are being most affected by climate change now and in the near future.
Yeah, yeah, and it's specifically for like climate catastrophes.
Yeah.
And it's separate from this fund for adaptation, which we just talked about
right,
before.
Yeah.
And yeah, back to the topic of islands that are sinking, for example, yeah. who's going to fund their relocation, you
right.
know? And like, where are they going to immigrate to, and what's going to happen to their cultures? So what was the most important for those countries was that they are able to secure funding mm-hmm. as soon as possible.
Yeah.
But for a lot of Global North countries, and given the fact that like for countries like Canada are suffering from inflation, and like there yeah. are a lot of people who are against like the carbon pricing policies mm-hmm. currently, but Canada and the US and the UK historically are still considered like the responsible ones
right.
for climate change.
Yep.
So they are kind of being pressured to pay up for the disasters that are going to be borne by these like the sinking islands, for example.
Yeah.
So a big conflict is always surrounding the Global South countries wanting more money, and then the Global North countries trying to avoid that responsibility.
Yeah.
And I think that's even more present in the youth dialogue, for example. Like, even when we're talking about anti-fossil fuels, right? And it's very true that we do need to phase out fossil fuels in order to mm-hmm. just get to the 1.5 goal. But if you talk to youth from, like, the UAE, for example,
yeah.
or youth from China, they're often saying that, well, these countries, like, they're still suffering a lot from poverty.
Yeah.
So their economic development depends so much on coal power, on
right.
fossil fuels,
yeah.
on oil. And if you take that away immediately, how are they going to ever lift themselves out of poverty, right?
Yeah.
And there really isn't like a very developed renewable energy infrastructure for
yeah.
these countries. So they also need money for that. And who's going to pay for that, right?
Right.
So when it comes to youths trying to connect with each other, I think that's a big conflict. It's just we really have to understand the other country's perspective and not just like force this, oh, you should stop using fossil fuels altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that, I think that alienates
right.
the other side a lot of the time.
So with a conference that big, how do youths make their voice heard? Because, I mean, you know, a lot of the negotiations, you know, that are happening are going to, you know, sort of be happening at the highest levels of mm-hmm. government leaders and ministers, and I suppose industry leaders as well. So how does youth make its voice heard at that at the conference?
That's actually a very good question, because you don't, like, youth are not a part of the negotiation process
yeah.
at all at COP. And what youth I've seen do is mainly that they participate in the trade show aspect of
yeah.
the climate conference that I just talked about. For example, at the China Pavilion, I remember reading like about COP25 back in Madrid, and that I remember the Chinese pavilion, they actually had youths implement a fashion show
yeah.
at the conference.
Right.
And youths from different countries can come in and they can be a model, or they can like actually witness the fashion show and how China is dealing with secondhand clothing. Or you would see, for example, youths, maybe they filmed their own documentary
mm-hmm.
at like one of these Global South countries, and then they can showcase their work at the conference, and
yeah.
then other youths could come and view them. But I would say the most direct way for youth to actually gain attention at the conference is probably through protesting.
Right.
So that's why there were a lot of anti-fossil fuel protests there,
yeah.
because when negotiations are happening, how do youths make their voices heard? And
yeah.
that's by going to the protest corner and and
right.
just making your viewpoints seen by these
yeah.
politicians.
Great. So what were your biggest takeaways from the conference? Like, you know, and particularly things that maybe you weren't expecting?
Things that I wasn't expecting. Well, I think just from my own academic perspective, since I'm studying actuarial science, like when you think about, for example, insurance companies, you don't think about climate change or like them doing good in society, right? And I met this one lady who actually works for this one insurance company in London, and what they're doing is that they're helping out with the loss and damage fund, for example. And like you wouldn't make that connection, but it's actually very relevant. So what her insurance company is doing is that they're working with, for example, the government of Palau, and they're implementing this parametric insurance scheme for coral reefs there. So what happens is that if, say, the ocean temperature is detected to be abnormal suddenly, and then they would pay out to the government immediately, like an amount of money, and then the island could use that money to compensate for the loss of the corals there. So insurance is used as a way to combat against climate change, and I think that's a very creative and like aspirational thing. Yeah, and I would love to develop my career that way, but at the same time, I think going back to what I spoke about with youths, I connected a lot with like youth from other countries and also youth delegates from UBC as well. And for us, we actually were talking about bridging this gap between Global North voices and Global South voices. And if it's possible, we want to be able to establish an organization or work with like an existing organization to say, pair up Vancouver youths with like youths from Beijing or youths from Mumbai in India in order to exchange like cultural viewpoints and actually foster this mutual understanding. And I think the mutual understanding is central to climate action.
And that was one of your big goals too.
Personal
goals from getting there is to start making those connections.
Yeah, but it's like coming back and implementing that is like a real challenge. But SFU actually has this great opportunity where by the end of February, we're going to be able to meet with the BC climate change minister.
Right.
And hopefully we'll be able to talk more about our takeaways there and maybe see if making this global connection is possible in any way. But I mean, it's a very big goal, and I'm not sure I'll have the resources. But yeah, I think that that's one of my lifelong dreams, if I can do that.
As someone who is there, and I imagine following the negotiations pretty closely while you were there, what were your feelings about the success or not of the conference? It sort of, it tends to be the issue that dominates the news coverage of it.
I think I have to start off with this like one remark. Usually like when you read on the news or when you watch TV about these conferences, like you would see, for example, John Kerry on TV and you would think, oh, he knows what he's doing. Like he can solve climate change. You know, he's going to these negotiations, he has an education, he's a very experienced diplomat. But when you're actually in the negotiating room and you see these countries compromising and being very frustrated with each other, you realize that actually no one knows how to solve climate change exactly.
Right.
And these conferences are all about compromises, and many people are going to walk out unhappy. Mm-hmm. And this happened in this conference as well. Even though COP28 was considered a success, just this one word in the final text, for example, it was called the world is going to transition away from fossil fuels, which it sounds logical, right?
Yeah. But
actually, what youths were protesting at the conference and many Global South countries were saying is that they wanted phase out of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
So just this difference between phase out and transition away is a huge difference.
Yeah.
Because phase out means stopping the use of fossil fuels altogether.
Yeah.
And for example, like countries like Tuvalu and Palau and Samoa were really supporting that because they're small island states. They're going to suffer from sea level rise within like a few decades into the future, right? Yep. So to them, it was a life or death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you got countries like UAE, Saudi Arabia saying, no, we do need fossil fuels. So it's a very conflicting viewpoint there.
Yeah.
And the final text of Transition Away actually just indicates that countries can determine by themselves if they want to stop using fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And they can use, for example, technologies like carbon removal to remove the greenhouse gases from the atmosphere back into the ground. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding that. But it's just, that one word is like, it's been the controversy of this whole crisis altogether.
So, I know you have to get away to a class in a few minutes. How would you characterize the overall experience of being at this conference in one sentence?
I would say it's probably a once in a lifetime experience, to be honest, because just to me, like when I was there, I was thinking, you know, how many people get to be in their 20s and you get to actually witness the making of history at a conference like this, right? And I think personally for me, it was a huge growing point for me. Like I got to see how many cool careers there are just related to climate. And also I got to foster connections that I wouldn't have ever in my life if I didn't go. And yeah, I think it's like, it was a once in a lifetime experience for me. So, and I felt very fulfilled in being able to learn about all of these different perspectives and being able to connect all these different cultural nuances. But I think there are things still that I want to improve upon in the future when it comes to COP, and I want to be able to make my own mark in climate action.
Great. So do you hope to attend a COP conference again?
If someone is willing to fund me, I would love to go, but they're very expensive.
Yeah.
I think students, like if I do get another chance, I would like for that chance to go to another willing student, because I have had my chance already, and I think every student should have this opportunity to be able to go just to like open up your mind and to diversify your perspectives. I think it's very worth it.
Great. Well, so thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Hylene Wang is an undergraduate student here at SFU and part of SFU's official delegation to the COP28 conference last month. Thanks for joining us today about your experience and some of your thoughts on it.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for coming up today with all the hassles on transit. All right. Thank you to Hylene Wang for joining us today. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We are going to give you a little bit about the birds.
This is Bird Note. A light dusting of snow whitens the hillsides along the Columbia River, a quiet backdrop to scores of apple orchards. Most of the fruit was harvested in autumn, but apples litter the ground, and a few still hang, frozen and thawed again and again. Suddenly, a flock of hundreds of birds rises from the ground beneath the apple trees, swarming in tight formation, wingtip to wingtip. The flock lifts and perches in orderly ranks in the top of a nearby poplar. These are Bohemian waxwings. Occasional visitors during the winter, down from their nesting grounds in the boreal forests of the north. They're nomads, come in search of fruit to sustain their winter wanderings. Bohemian waxwings, larger kin of cedar waxwings, are exquisite, with silken plumage, a jaunty crest, black mask, and wings daubed, as if with sealing wax, in red, yellow, white, and black. Add to this a tail dipped in yellow, and you have a bird that seems to have sprung from a painter's palette. Quickly, the flock is off again, swirling up the canyon to adorn the winter branches of another orchard. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
So one of the things we didn't have a chance to talk about in our interview with Hyleen was about some of the career opportunities, which is sort of something you learned a lot about at the conference. But you're sharing some of that information through your Instagram, right?
Yes. It wasn't my personal Instagram, but I was sharing these Instagram stories that I filmed on Simon Fraser's official Instagram. So yeah.